Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome back to our Future History Week. Today we are, well, I'm always excited. I'm even more excited. One of my favourite people in the world is here today. And Beth, who is another one of my favourite people in the world. Let me not take anything away from her. But we wanted to talk about, so Beth, you know how like we dig up stuff from 1,000 years ago and try and figure out people, how people lived and stuff?
Yeah, isn't that what we do as historians?
Well, I'm thinking more archaeologists. Because we have an archaeologist with us, and that is Gilad Jaffe. Hello, Gilad.
Hello. Hello.
He's got stuff to talk about in terms of what people are going to dig up thousands of years from now and make of us lunatics.
This is actually based on a lecture I've given quite a few times. It actually started as a joke through an artist friend of mine in Israel. He put online a drawing he made of like things he had on his table. And one of the things was an R2-D2 doll of Star Wars. Mm. And I said, you know, he also does shirts, like prints shirts from his art. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, if you make a shirt of that, I'll give you a lecture that connects Star Wars and archaeology. And he said, there's no way you can connect Star Wars and archaeology. And I said, try me.
Challenge accepted.
Exactly. And then he made the shirt. So then I had to come up with the lecture. But then it grew and it grew, and I gave it in the best place was I gave it at a science fiction fantasy con, which was amazing.
Oh, but you would have been the coolest person there as an archaeologist. That must have been.
Well, you know, it's a sci-fi fantasy con. Everyone's nerds. No one's
yeah, cool. You would have been like the least nerdy person there.
A king of the nerds.
Could have been. Could have been. Yeah. Well, I wore a suit and I put on my Gryffindor Harry Potter tie. So I don't know.
Definitely. This is like Zach at the Great War Group conference. Zach found himself in the position of being the most sought after man at the conference, which I don't think that's happened to him anywhere or ever will again. But it means he has a whole new appreciation for the First World War, doesn't it, Beth?
It does indeed. We've brought him to the dark side.
We have. So, Gilad, talk to us then. Tell us what's in your lecture. What are people going to pick up?
That's what I was saying. The title of the lecture is Harry Potter, Star Wars, and the Archaeology of the Future. And it's basically a run through human beings' documentation of humanity and where it came from and what it might look like in the future and how. And I promise you, it connects to Star Wars and to Harry Potter in my opinion, in a very fun way. But I have to remember that archaeology is basically, probably your listeners know, but I will go over it again. Basically, it's a science of reconstructing the past based on the actual finds in the ground. And as you know, because I think we did a whole chapter on biblical archaeology, right, Alex? So, and then we talked that in the Bible specifically, it's a problematic like subgenre because when something doesn't fit with the Bible, then people don't like it. Then, well, if it doesn't fit, it's okay. It just means you have to ask the question why. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, first of all, ask yourselves, what is documentation? In my opinion, we can even count the cave drawings of Lascaux in France as human documentation. And the reason, there really is no reason why. We're talking about the famous cave found in 1948. You know the story with the dog?
Yeah. No, I don't. Is this
the story?
Like a 17-year-old kid went for a walk with his dog and his dog fell into a hole. So he went and got his friends back and they went in to get the dog out and they found the cave. And that's how the Lascaux, the famous Lascaux cave with all the paintings, with the bull room, which has the biggest bull drawn in prehistory. I think it's about 5 meters long, the drawing, which is pretty sure it's not an accurate depiction of a bull, because a 5-meter long bull would be one hell of a creature. So these are the earliest stages of documentation, and it grows and changes as we go. If we skip, let's say 7,000 years ahead, you get to the mid 4th millennium BC, and then we have the first writing systems, which of course are also, as you might say, prehistoric. If you might say, we're talking about cuneiform writing in Mesopotamia, or the famous hieroglyphs, the ever enigmatic hieroglyphs. There's something about the Egyptians, they steal the thunder from everybody else. It's quite annoying in a certain way. I don't know who does that in World War I, but in archaeology, it's Egyptians.
I think Nikolai would say it's the Western Front, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
It's always bitching about it.
The Belgians with their chocolates, so you know.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. A bit of a lull over there.
Yeah.
So
go on.
So these writing systems are well, of course, much, much more advanced. Well, it might surprise you, but the first one to be deciphered was actually the hieroglyphics. And they're not writing systems in the form that you and I use today. It's called pictographs. It actually, what it means, it just tells you a symbol. It gives you the idea. To give you a good example, think of the worldwide known symbol for toilet, the man and woman sign. It doesn't matter what language you speak, what language you read, what you do or do not know. If you see that symbol wherever you are in the world, you know that's the toilet. Mm. That's a pictograph. That's what it does. It sends the idea, and everybody knows what it means. Contrary to a logogram, which is a bit different, because a logogram is actually a symbol which means a whole word. And the best example for that is think of the symbol of percent, 3%, let's say. So you see that symbol, you know what word it means. These, of course, are much more complicated systems, and human beings start to actually document themselves. Most of the documentation in ancient times is might not surprise you, bureaucracy. Basically, writing was invented in order to manage the economy and the bureaucracy and everything. If I'm going too fast or you have questions, please do ask. So as the time goes by, of course, different needs arise. I will state that the earliest narrative, or let's say prose writing we have, is also probably heard of the Gilgamesh tablets.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Discovered by the British Henry Layard in the late 19th century. He excavated them, by the way, very poorly. He actually bought them all in one big mess. It took them 14 years to sort them out, understanding which order they before they could even understand what's written on them. So that's actually considered the earliest, let's say, I'm giving here big air quotes, novel in history. It's actually a document that's not bureaucratic. It's not some king saying how good he is or how many battles he won. It's actually just a fable, an actual story. The problem with the Gilgamesh is, of course, that there was a king, an ancient Sumerian king called Gilgamesh, the fifth ruler of Sumer. So it's a big question, is or isn't it? How much historical accuracy does it have? You jump to the next phase and you have the invention of the alphabet, which is not attributed to the Greeks, as some people once told me. The Greeks did not invent the alphabet. They didn't invent the first version of the Latin alphabet. It's a different story. Alphabet was invented by slaves in the mining site in southern Sinai Peninsula in somewhere around 1200 BC. And that, of course, leads to the Phoenician alphabet, which that leads to the Greek alphabet. And the Greeks were the ones to switch the direction. I'm assuming you know that all Semite languages are written from right to left to this day. Hebrew, Arabic, Persian, all those. And then you have the Latin ones, which are written from left to right. The reason is because the Greeks were the ones to introduce writing in ink. So given that most people are right-handed and most of the elite were probably right-handed, the people who wrote, they switched the direction so the ink won't smudge as you write. Because if you're right-handed and you write from right to left, you can smudge the ink. Ask any left person, they'll tell you to this day.
Question.
But you're both?
No, no, I'm not. I have a question. You said the Greeks are the first to use ink. What did the Egyptians use?
It's pigments. It's not ink in the way that we know it, that flows out, that flows from let's say the edge of the feather, as we know that romanticized version that the person writes with feather and ink. So the fact that it was more flowing, more fluid, more wet on the parchment, it was more liable to smudge. Hence, they changed the direction. And then the Romans built their Latin alphabet on the Greek alphabet, which gives us the way we are writing all today. Given, putting aside Far East languages, the Indo-European languages, basically all the languages that we deal with today have their roots in the Phoenician alphabet, which is pretty amazing as it is. Now, the documentation in this period, this is a major change because, of course, we have all the Greek philosophers, playwrights, and all those things. So we actually see that human beings have become much more, their needs have changed, and they become much more aware of how to satisfy those needs. And the next jump is might be the biggest, and that brings us to Johann Gutenberg. I swear this will get to future archaeologists. Don't worry.
No, this is really interesting.
We'll get there.
Yeah,
we trust you.
Building up to. And of course, he invented the mobile press, which, that was the first time anybody could actually reprint something in more than one copy and do it fairly quickly and fairly easily. Trivia question. How many Gutenberg Bibles do we know still exist in the world? Original ones.
It's either going to be really, really small or like a much bigger number than you expect. I'm going to go small. I'm going to go like 2.
Alex?
Go on. I say 3.
Okay. 47.
Ah.
But the catch is we only know the location of 44. There are 3 more that we know that survived. I don't know how they know it survived. But they're in some kind of private collection. Nobody knows where they are.
You can't say things like that to Beth. She's like the most over-competitive person in the world. She's going to be on a mission to track them down now.
I'm going
to
go and find all these private collections and find the 3 Bibles.
So that's your winter sorted out. So Gutenberg, really, that's the birth of, you know, books. And we all love books. OBS.
Mm-hmm. too much.
Yeah, so that gives, again, this has a major effect on all of culture because much more people have access, much more people begin reading. The whole character of the writing changes, much more novel, but we get maybe equal amount of novels and bureaucracy. Bureaucracy never dies, of course. It never will die. When the earth will explode, whatever will remain is bureaucracy. That's a good one. And like maybe cockroaches. So, you know, the thing is that the documentation, and when I mean documentation, I mean like every form of writing that talks about daily or regular life, and it gets more and more elaborate. And we have letters. Say first letters home that I know of from the war front are Napoleonic army soldiers' letters that were sent back home. And maybe the highest point of this self-documentation in writing is in the 20th century, World War I, World War II. How much research that you girls know is based on letters written from home from soldiers? Huge amounts
of it.
Lots of it. And that's it, because this is a point where most people could read and write basically enough, and they would send letters. And these letters, good for us historians, stayed. So we can research them. We can check this letter and this letter, and these two soldiers served together this day and this on this day, and the events and correlate between events. And that's actually how we do the research. And The thing is that this goes on until the beginning of the 21st century. And then what gets invented? Facebook.
Social media.
Or should we say Meta? I understand they changed their names. So I don't know. And this is a big change. Social network has flipped the way we treat documentation. And I'm going to fixate on one issue specifically, and that's photographs, because it's the best example. There's a famous saying that if your house starts burning, what do? You grab the photo albums and you run out, because basically everything else you can change. You can buy, you can get it back. But photos that you took of yourself, of your children, of your family 20 years ago, and I'm not talking about digital stored in the cloud somewhere in Bill Gates' office, and actual photos that you can't reprint, if they're gone, they're gone. And social media has changed that whole concept, because we are now taking digital photos nearly exclusively, I think. When was the last time one of you printed a photo?
Beth printed loads last week, but that was only for the conference. Before that...
No. I'll rephrase. When was the last time one of you printed for herself personal photos?
I've grown up in a generation where all of our photos have basically been online.
Exactly. Right. So then came Instagram, and then Facebook bought Instagram because they understood that photos were the whole rage, and then people up. No, the numbers are. Wait, I got this. I came prepared. Don't think I have the numbers here. This is fairly updated to today. We're talking about 2.3 million monthly users on Facebook, and 1.5 billion daily users. Something like 250 billion photos are on Facebook currently. And this is, I'm assuming the numbers are higher. If we go to Instagram, you get the numbers are crazy. You have 50 billion photos have been uploaded to Instagram to this day, more or less, let's say. Okay, not to this day, a few months ago. But the numbers are amazing. And I'm assuming that 0.00 something of these photos have been printed. So basically, we don't have physical photos with us anymore. Let's go to the second issue. When was the last time one of you wrote a letter, actual pen and paper, and sent it by mail? I'm not condescending. I don't do these things myself. It's not like I'm all day, scribbling with my quill.
Probably when I was doing the Eton book, I dealt with quite a lot of elderly people, and it was more appropriate than email.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it counts, but sending out wedding invitations, maybe.
Well,
write them up.
You would think it wouldn't count, but you know what? If you look at, let's say, Linear B tablets with texts from Crete, we're talking Minoan Crete, somewhere around 14th, 13th century BC. Mm. All you have there is bureaucracy, and we're talking about the dullest bureaucracy you can think about. We're talking about how many sheep the palace had, how many they gave to the herders in the island, how many sheep each herder got, and then how much he was supposed to give back, how much he actually gave back, and what's the deficit. And it sounds boring, but you suddenly see a pattern arise, and you understand that the herders weren't suckers. They got sheep, and then when they had bad sheep or sick sheep, they would trade them into the palace's herd and keep the good ones for themselves. They would actually use the lack of control of the palace for their own advantage, and actually make their herds better than they were. If you look, most coffee shops today, you look at the receipt. Usually you have your name on top, because they ask your name, if they write it right or not. For some reason, Starbucks insists on writing my name as Dylan every time.
I don't think they've ever, ever got anyone's name right ever, but the thought's there, right?
Might be. But you have your name on the top. You have a date. You have an hour. You have a location of the coffee shop. You have what you bought. How much did it cost? How much did you actually pay? Did you pay in card? Did you pay in cash? How much change you got back? Now take all of these small coffee bills, and you can build a picture of that coffee house when it was established, when it stopped working, when was its peak. It sounds boring, but and this is coffee. I'm just giving a very boring example on purpose. But these are. It's the same thing with the sheep in Crete. It's the same thing. It sounds boring, but suddenly a different picture arises when you start to connect all this data together. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't do that anymore. Even if they print the receipts, they throw them in the bin because they got a digital copy anyway in the computer, which they send to their accountant later. You don't take the receipt. None of us take receipts from coffee houses. Only really, you know, independent.
Stingy people who want to claim the tax back and for
exactly. Only and I've dealt with enough taxes in my life. I've never handed in a coffee bill. Never. I feel ashamed. But so we don't have pictures of ourselves. We don't have letters that we write. We have the bills. So we have electric bills, water bills, stuff like that. But we don't have anything that's speaking directly of our actual life, not how much you pay for electricity, but what did you do while you were using that electricity? We don't know. And this is social media. For good or for bad, this is the world of social media. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, during all this, 1977, Star Wars, which is now called Episode 4, goes out and becomes this huge phenomenon. Now, Star Wars to date has, if we only take into consideration the nine major movies, so you have like nine major movies, and you have tons of books, you have movies, and these were all filmed in places that exist. Like, for example, if you go to Tunisia, to Umm Jamal, which is an actual village where scenes from The Phantom Menace were shot, you can see that place. If you go to the island of Djerba, which is just off the coast of Tunisia, you can actually see to this day the prop, the house they built as Obi-Wan Kenobi's house in which the scenes were filmed. It's still there. You can even find the small famous igloo of Luke Skywalker's aunt and uncle where he lived at the beginning of the movie. It's still there in the desert. You can find pictures of it online. It's no problem. If you can even go further to places like I might be pronouncing this wrong. You're British, you might know Skellig Michael in Southern Ireland. Is that how you say it? I think so. Anyway, it's
really weird.
It's a couple of it's a nature reserve, islands nature reserve, which have which a group of monks used to live on. The buildings are still there. They filmed scenes from The Force Awakens over there. You can take it to very many places. The most famous might be the famous Mayan city of Tikal, which most people know how it looks, with the famous temple number one, the high one in the middle. And they use that as a backdrop for the Rebels' own base in Star Wars Episode 4. And they actually superimpose the scenes on the site. The site is the site. It's one of the most amazing and important sites of Southern America, of Central America, pre-Spanish conquest. But it looks completely believable as that planet, which is called Yavin 4 in that movie. So that's Star Wars. And oh, and keeping in consideration, I love this small part that Star Wars always starts with a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So we have a little bit of a time anchor. But I also promised you Harry Potter, and Harry Potter is not less interesting. I'm assuming most of our listeners know about Harry Potter and the books and the movies came out. The first one came out in 1997, would you believe, 24 years. How old do you feel now?
Yeah.
and of course a huge phenomenon. We have seven main books. Also there's an eighth one with the cursed child. You have the movies. We also have places. I think this is called Anik Castle. I'm never sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. So, and it's a real, it's a castle still being used north. It's in Northumberland. I think it's the seat of the Duke of Northumberland, if I read correctly. And this was used for all the outer scenes of Hogwarts in the first movies. Complete. As it is, they filmed in the castle. You also have scenes shot, of course, outside the famous St. Pancras, posing as King's Cross, because King's Cross looks too modern, so it's not like Gothic enough, so they use St. Pancras, where you can see the car fly above the train station in the second movie. Many other locations. And I haven't yet even started to talk about, what's this?
The train, the Harry Potter train.
I don't remember the name of the bridge, but yeah, you're getting it.
Glenfinnan.
Glenfinnan Bridge, right. Yeah. So we haven't even started to talk about, you know, the pop figurines?
Yes.
Yes, very popular. We have pop figurines of Harry and Ron, Hermione, Hagrid, and everybody. We have pop figurines of Luke Skywalker and all the major characters from Star Wars and Harry Potter. The amount of merchandise, these two, and I'm talking only about these two franchises, there's many more. The amount of merchandise these franchises produce and that is sold. I mean, if you would walk into my 17-year-old's daughter's room in Israel like 2 years ago, everything was Harry Potter, down to the Harry Potter sweater she bought at the studio tour. So she even has like a Gryffindor Hogwarts uniform to wear. It's amazing. Now, multiply this by the whole world, children, in an absurd way, we might reach a level where there's more evidence of the existence of Luke Skywalker and Harry Potter than there is of regular people, because we're not leaving anything behind. Everything's on Facebook. And that's,
I think, that we worship some little ginger schoolboy as a god the world over.
It could be. It sounds stupid. I'm not going to the places of we worship. What I'm saying is that if theoretically, and then I turn to a few like internet and social media experts, because I know little about this, and I ask them, can these servers break down? Can this be deleted? And of course, I said no, very, very slim chance. But the thing is that we do have one example. We do have one example of something like this happening. This happened in 2019, 20th of March 2019. I don't know if you remember MySpace. MySpace, yeah, it was a social network before Facebook existed. And their servers got wiped. And billions of songs and art pieces were wiped. They actually managed to salvage a big chunk of it in a weird way, because it was downloaded to a different server in University of California for research. So, but everything that was on MySpace is gone. And there's no way to retrieve it. Imagine that happening to Facebook or Google or Twitter. And we're essentially using Facebook and Instagram as our personal photo albums.
Yes.
And our personal, some people are actively using Twitter and Facebook as their journal. Dear diary, today I drank 3% milk, you know. So
here is my dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Look what I ate. I never understood that, you know, photoing your food. People do. But again, so if all this gets wiped out, what are we leaving behind us? Because think about it. If Schliemann would have found Troy, but we had nothing written about it, it would be nothing but very, very nice and impressive walls with lovely architecture, lovely gold and bronze jewelry. But how does it all fit together? Archaeology can only take you a certain distance. You can find the finds. You can find the pottery and the jewelry and the flint tools and maybe a writing carved in stone and the walls and architecture. But you need the history to give you context. You need, that's a big problem. I talked about it at the beginning. That's a big problem with biblical archaeology, that the writing, the historical source of biblical archaeology is a flawed source. We can't trust it enough. So we have a problem connecting the dots. That's why doing archaeology in Hellenistic and Roman periods is much easier. Documentation is much more believable. And to a certain extent, it exists much more. We have much more documentation. So we might, and this is a theory, and it is a theory because I have no way to back it up because it hasn't happened yet. We're talking about the future. So, so the theory is that we're not documenting ourselves. And absurdly, we're allowing things that don't really exist to be ultra-documented in stupid ways, maybe. But it is happening. It is happening. And again, think about it. In archaeology, if you find something, that's the find, that's the fact, that what defines the answer. If you know it happened or not, depends on if you have a historical resource to back it up. So I can, if I had no historical source, I could claim that the destruction of Pompeii was done by a ravaging army of barbarians who brought a lot of volcanic ash with them in buckets and spread it all over the city.
Yeah.
If I don't have an historical source, go contradict me.
Yeah.
Okay, do it. And so it's a funny thing to think about. But in a certain way, I'm looking at it and I can see it happening. And of course, it doesn't have to stop at Harry Potter and Star Wars. Of course, you know, we can find lots of things. Think about maybe the most famous that everybody knows. Two most famous examples are the set of Hobbiton in New Zealand, Lord of the Rings, and you're getting excited.
Yeah. She went there on her honeymoon.
I've been there.
Ah, you've been there.
Nice. Running around like the little hobbit that I am.
With your little stumpy.
Do you have hair on your feet?
No comment.
No, she can't be a hobbit because she has stumpy little, like, child feet. Don't hobbits have big hairy feet?
Yeah.
It won't help the readers, but I have the one read. Yeah. Even I'm contributing to the problem with historical future documentation, you see? So you have Hobbiton, which again, who's to say in 500 years people won't grasp it differently than we are? Another famous example from the recent years, I never saw it because I read the books, but we're talking about King's Landing, the famous walls in Dubrovnik. Everybody knows that those walls are representation of King's Landing in the TV series. So again, what's to say? And this is an even more grounded scenery if someone, you know, imagine that the Song of Ice and Fire is the only book left in the world.
I laugh my head off if the archaeologists spend their entire lives looking for that church that got blown up in where they just run out of plot in like season 6 and blew up the red church or whatever. They just can't find any evidence of the explosion. It must be around here somewhere.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, it's dangerous because There is a certain type of archaeologist, I'm going to say this recorded on record, that, you know, they know before they reach the site, they know already what they found. It's just that the dirt is in the way, they have to move it. So basically, the whole, what I'm trying to say is that we actually need to pay a little bit more attention about what we're leaving behind. Because we're actually not doing too much to leave stuff behind. Now, if you for 1 minute think that the houses we're living in today will last as long as houses we're excavating, you're delusional. There is no way. So basically, we might reach a point where not only has the, let's say, humanitarian side of our documentation disappeared, we're hardly leaving any physical evidence because these buildings will crumble. They're not meant to last 500 years. We're not talking about the pyramids. We're not talking about the palaces in Mesopotamia or the palace in Knossos in Crete. Our buildings can't stand that much time. So if we want to be remembered, we have to start taking action for that to happen. Because basically, if you look at it now, archaeologists of the future will still be excavating things that happened before us because they won't find us.
That's a complete... So what you're saying is, this was a very elaborate way of saying that future archaeology is doomed because we're idiots.
No, it's a way of saying that future archaeology will be dealing with some kind of time gap that they might not be able to understand, and they might not know what happened there. It's more likely that future archaeology will believe that the 20th and 21st century was a period ruled by children or space gods fighting each other, than by people who, you know, and I, you know what, honestly, you know, thinking about it as we talk, I don't know what's better, children, space gods, or crazies like Saddam Hussein and Hitler. I don't know, you know, what sounds better?
It's mad.
What future past do you want?
Thank you so much for coming on to basically blow our minds with the idea of what the archaeology of the future will look like. I love the concept that we might be looking at people 1,000 years from now thinking the 20th and 21st century were like some kind of dark ages, because there's nothing left except little alien toys.
We're doing so much. We're doing so much, but nothing is physical. And remember, archaeology is physical, because you see, we all love books. I got this new book today. I'm really excited.
Oh, sniff it. What does it smell like?
Oh, it's a. Do you know Abe's Books, the ones that sell the old books?
Yeah.
So I got it from there. It's called Digging for God and Country.
Excellent. Yeah. I think. Do you know what I think?
It's
I have
about
that.
By Neil Asher Silver. I don't really like the writer too much. It's kind of a pompous asshole. But does he not cover?
I think I have it because there's relevant to the Palestine Exploration Fund in there.
Oh, of course, of course. You can't talk about history of excavation in Israel without talking about the PES.
Yeah, so it might be Kitchener and his few years out there is my obsession.
Kitchener and Condor and all those guys.
I just found a guy called Bruno in France with a bookstore who has masses and masses of First World War French stuff. And he may have my car details, and I may be screwed. Paying my phone bill this month, but we'll deal with that when I get to it. Gilad, you've been amazing as ever.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling our existence into question.
You utterly deserve glorious cartoon of you as Princess Leia that we've given you.
Yes, and you know, Alex knows this, but I'm really fun at parties. So. Goodbye.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.